Classics. I'm your host, Superfan Giovanni. This is the podcast where we play select clips and highlights from all 14 years of the Adam Carolla Show and over 3,500 episodes. If you'd like to request a clip, please email us at classics@adamcarolla.com. And if you can't get enough of this show, make sure you subscribe to the Carolla Classics RSS feed. It's a separate show that airs a bonus episode every Sunday. All of the clips that were planned for today were scrapped, including the listener requests, due to the death of Jerry Springer. Adam and Jerry actually go way back to Loveline. Jerry Springer was on episode 158 of Classic Loveline from May of 1996, less than a year into Adam's run on the show. This was due to the popularity of his talk show, The Jerry Springer Show, at the time, and how it became a media phenomenon, and he was just kind of everywhere. He's ubiquitous. He returned to Loveline in 1998 for episode 814, promoting Ringmaster. The fictionalized version of his life and show was made for a feature film. Jerry didn't appear on the KLSX Morning Show when Adam hosted that from 2006 to 2009. He did appear on the podcast, and he came up with some very interesting episodes ranging from him hosting the show to appearing and talking about his family and the Holocaust. And there's even a very interesting take a knee. We're going to highlight clips from all of his appearances on the Adam Carolla Show as a tribute to this really great dude that a lot of people don't know much about aside from his show, which may give him the wrong opinion about who he was as a person. Starting out with Adam Carolla Show 1877, Steve Wilkos, Gina Grad, Brian Bishop. That'd be fun to start with a clip of a guy whose career only exists because of Jerry. Check it out.
So you get from the Marine Corps, that's an easy transition to the police department. But then the Jerry Springer part.
I was walking out of the police station one night in 1994, and my buddy Mike McDermott just said, hey, you want to work a side job tomorrow? And as a policeman, you're always working side jobs because you want to make a little more money. I said, sure, what is it? He said, the Jerry Springer Show. I never even heard of Jerry Springer at this point. And I later found out he was the mayor of Cincinnati. But, so I showed up one day, and then a couple weeks later, they called me back to work another show. And then the next season when I came back, they went an entirely different direction. So that first season I was there at the beginning of 1994, it was like serious type shows.
It was a semi-serious talk show for a short period of time.
And the first show I worked on was a Ku Klux Klan show.
It was topical and it dealt with
current events.
But then when I came back over the summer, after summer into the fall, they just started doing love triangles and fights. And what was funny was,
sweet spot.
I really didn't think it was a big deal. And I didn't tell anybody I was working on a Springer show. Like, my parents live in Florida. And so I had a side gig on a TV show that I never was on. I wasn't like I was on the show. So then they started going this direction. And then I'll never forget, they did this story about these three gay guys. And they kept fighting. And they wouldn't stop. So Jerry finally took me out of the audience and said, just sit between these guys. Don't let them fight. So then my mom's friend saw the show and said, your son is gay.
Oh,
he's
in
a gay love triangle. My mom called me up. She's like, you're on some TV show. I go, no, Mom, I do security for the show.
Never fired my gun. No. Never.
Now, excuse me, you have to get to Homo Hill. Homo Park.
I mean, sorry. Yeah. Gary, you can fast forward to the range. I don't have to bore everyone with the stuff.
But I know as a teenager who was watching Jerry Springer faithfully, you were quite beloved by the ladies and everybody.
Sat in the front row.
Yep.
The thing about Springer, because I interviewed him sort of one-on-one for Take a Knee, he was, the guy was marching in civil protests, the original Black Lives Matter movement back in the 60s. As it's now known. I mean, the guy was very politically active. He was a mayor.
He still is.
He's a serious guy. So I could see when he went to go do a talk show that was going to be the whole direction the show was going to go.
Right.
He's very politically active and a very serious guy and, product of the 60s and the rebellion and all that stuff. So I could see. And then, of course, but that's a great part. You start off as a cop. You end up with your own syndicated TV show. Jerry starts off as a political activist and then ends up doing paternity tests and then people getting throwing chairs at each other. That's why you're a fool to try to even predict where it's going to go.
Yeah, it's, you know, and I say, like, people ask me all the time, how do you get your own TV show? And I'm like, I don't know. Yeah. I really don't, because I never tried. I never auditioned. I never wanted it. It was just, NBC said, you're going to have your own show and you're going to do it. And I was an employee, so I had to do it. You know, I didn't even want it, to be honest. And after the first year, I certainly didn't want it.
Well, why? Why after?
It just, there's so much pressure. I didn't like the way I was being produced. I just dreaded, like, and I was working all the time that first season trying to make the show go into a second season. And my children were really small at the time, and I just hated it. But then when I came back for the second season, they fired the original executive producer, and they put my wife in charge, and my life got 100% better then.
Wow. Yeah, people don't realize, even when – it's so funny, but if you talk to my buddy Kevin Hinch, he's doing Last Man Standing with Tim Allen. You call that guy season one, it's like beleaguered, frustrated, getting notes from everybody. You know, talk to him the other day, it's like, how's it going? Cruising along.
We're shooting right now. Why? What's up?
Yeah, I'm actually on camera.
Well, you know, you know what you were saying earlier, and I thought was funny, was when you said, like, when people don't realize they're getting canceled or fired, you know, from their TV job. In the first season of my show, I used to have a Google alert on my name. So that first season, I had really bad time sleeping. So I woke up one morning at like 3 o'clock in the morning. I couldn't sleep. So I go downstairs, I open up the computer, and there it was. Steve Wilkos to be canceled. And they were going to hire a guy named T.D. Jakes that were going to give him a show. And I was like, oh, my God, this is in. And so, like, I had quit the police department by 6 or 7 years at this point. I wasn't going back to that. I didn't know if I was going to be able to go back on Springer. So I'm like, I'm dead. And I didn't wake up my wife. I let her sleep, and then I woke up. And then NBC executives called me the next day, and they were like, you know, we don't want you to worry. I go, the fact that you're calling me, I'm worried.
Don't worry.
What I mean? Like,
yeah.
But then we managed to make it into season two, and thank God, and it's been a good ride ever since.
We have me at the range, if you want to check out 30 seconds of that. The guy, the first guy with the gun, who I don't end up shooting, looks... who's the guy from Swingers who was playing Miniature Golf?
Oh, yes.
Ron Livingston.
Ron, he looks a lot like Ron Livingston with a beard.
Office Space.
But yeah, Office Space. Sorry.
Go ahead. Same guy.
Oh, we can use... I'll use my button. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I can do that sort of bad boy play a thing where I hold it sideways and start yelling, calling everyone bitch. Yeah, too. Now halt! Halt!
Well, that's pretty good shooting.
Oh, wait, that comes first?
Yeah, that usually comes first, yeah.
Okay, well, I'll straighten that out on the street. Let me tell you something. I don't play by the book. I play by this pamphlet. It has all the stuff the book has in it, but it's smaller. It's an easier read.
See the melon?
Yeah.
That's
any questions? I didn't think so. Now, seriously, did you have any questions?
Not at all.
Shooting a slug. It's like shooting a huge ball bearing. This guys, I can't believe they let me even do this. I don't know where's the
it comes later.
Go back to the range, but you can see me. I got to shoot the machine gun, I got to shoot everything. I never even fired a gun before.
How'd you feel?
I'm one of these people that's never been attracted to guns. I come from a sort of non-gun family.
Really?
Yeah.
You have a non-TV family.
And we didn't do a lot of hunting in North Hollywood. And I do have sort of good hand-eye coordination, so I sort of figured I could handle it, but I just didn't. Was never something I was excited about. And then when I was done, I was just done. Yeah. Here's a machine gun, by the way. Shall I start it?
Top of the world, Mom! Top of the world!
Oh, no.
I think I got him that time.
You think so?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure.
She's all shot up. He's missed.
Would have probably gone, cleared her shoulder and probably caught him, you know, in his shoulder.
Yeah.
That's my plan.
Okay.
I don't want them to think I'm shooting it at the perp. My plan is I'm shooting at the hostage, but the bullet's passing through.
The guy was taking me seriously the entire time.
He's like, you're not very good at this.
Which always makes it fun. I would argue, first time I ever picked up a machine gun in my life, and I was able to pretty much concentrate it just on her from about 50, 60 feet away. I wasn't too shabby. The thing that's funny, I forgot about, is they give you a mailbox in there to shoot behind.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah, actually,
keep it real.
Tactical.
Yeah. But then in the street, you get trapped behind a parking meter and you're screwed, you know? Yeah. You don't get the cover of the mailbox, you know?
I've seen the town. That doesn't work.
Yeah, it does not work. All right. That was a fun experience. One of the, and you must get this with TV, too, is you get to kind of see a lot, do a lot, experience a lot.
Just even being out here this week, I brought my kids out and, you know, we're doing all the touristy things and... So it's fun. But, you know, even being with Jerry all those years, we did, you know, Mardi Gras. And I went to Amsterdam and London, Jamaica and Mexico and, you know, just traveling all over the world and just, you know, Kentucky Derby, you know, just doing a lot of cool things being in TV.
He's a sweet guy. Imagine
he's super nice.
Be a really good boss.
Yeah, he was a great guy. I mean, I worked with him, you know, for 14 years. I never saw him yell at anybody. Never.
Yeah, he has a great sort of bedside manner and a good demeanor and a nice vibe. And it's really, you sort of would, I mean, at least if you only knew him from the show, you might expect the guy to possibly be a head case off the whatever because, you know, it's the Rosie O'Donnell syndrome. You don't know what it's like backstage. But, God, he doesn't give that off at all when you're one-on-one with him.
It's like the inverse of your Rosie theory, which is he has this wild and crazy show that's bigger than life and characters and craziness. But off the air, he's just a very, very
gentle,
almost demure guy.
And generous as well, just sort of emotionally. All right, and as a lover.
All right, those Steve Wilkos in 2016 on The Adam Carolla Show. Coming up next, we have Jerry himself, Adam Carolla Show 1311, Jerry Springer, Cindy Cabanera, Allison Rose, and Brian Bishop. This one's from April 2014. Jerry's hosting the show. What? This is part one. We'll play part two tomorrow on the Carolla Classics feed. Jerry's on the show even more than Adam knows about. Check it out.
From Carolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Tonight's guest host, Jerry Springer. With guest, author Cindy Campanera, plus Allison Rosen on news, Paul Bryan on sound effects, and a spirited round of blah, blah, blah. And now, a man who has personally met several of our definitely not a Jews, Jerry Springer.
Oh, please, don't get up. Don't get up. That is so kind of you. And here I am sitting in for Adam, and how cool is that?
It's very cool.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
How are you feeling? You said that you were a little bit nervous before we started.
Oh, I didn't sleep last night. I mean, how do you sit in for Adam? I used to be on Adam's old radio show years ago, and then he and Dr. Drew had the TV show and all that. So he's a real nice guy. But when you come into the studio here and you see his cars and his he's serious about that stuff, isn't he?
He is, and at this studio, this is just probably a quarter to a third of the cars he has, right, guys?
Yeah. More,
less than that?
10%.
He's seriously? Yeah. If you ask him how many cars he has, he doesn't even know.
Is he going to be like Jay Leno? Is that what
yes,
we're talking
he's
about?
Yes, he's friends with Jay Leno.
Because of the cars, because otherwise they wouldn't like each other.
Right.
No, I just said that. I have no idea.
He's serious, but he's also very pragmatic about it, because what he'll do is he'll schedule live podcasts around races that he's entering. So he'll sort of get a twofer out of it.
Well, that's a reason to have a fast car. Because, see, like, I just got a fast car.
What'd you get?
Well, it's a Maserati. But anyway, here's the point.
Jerry Springer money.
Jerry Springer money. It's useless. I live in Sarasota, and I got this car that can go 200 miles an hour.
How long did it take you to get here from Sarasota?
That was on my plane. So, you don't have a plane. I'm so sorry.
Oh.
What a loser.
How many planes do you
Allison,
have?
Allison, what a loser. So anyway.
Not
having a plane.
Burn.
I'll pick you up at the bus stop. So how about this? Yeah. So, but anyway, so you get finally, you know, look, I'm 70. So at my age, it's no longer a midlife crisis.
It's Jerry time.
This is an end of life crisis. Yeah. I mean, you're 70. You're not middle aged.
It's the final act.
I'm old. Yeah. I am old. No. How many people make it to 140? Moses.
Outside of him, not many.
Not many.
Not many.
No, no. So this is kind of, this is my
song. How do you like the Maserati?
Save the tape in case this is my last show ever.
How do you like the Maserati?
Well, it's lovely, but here's the embarrassing story about it. I know nothing about cars. So I was basically in just, you know, buying my wife a car because she's had this car since 1997, a BMW, nice car. But anyway, so she's had it since 97. I keep saying, you got to get a new car. You got to get – and, she just likes her old car. So we go, and we're driving down the street, and there's a Jaguar dealership. So we go, come on, a convertible. We're in Florida. It's warm. It is great. So we go in, and they have all these cars in the showroom, and then I see this beautiful blue convertible, white interior. I say, honey, this is great. Here, I'll get you this one. And she looks at it. Yeah, it is pretty. But she said, that's a Maserati. So she says, I'm not getting one. She says, you go in it. So when I go out to buy her a car, I bought it.
So she was okay
for myself.
She was okay with the Jaguar,
she says,
but she didn't want the Maserati?
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, there's probably, whatever. But you can go 200 miles an hour. But when you're driving in Sarasota, where everyone is 93 and over, you can't go more than 4 miles an hour. And it's absurd, a total waste of money.
You must get – it's a convertible.
Yes.
You must get a lot of looks. I mean, Jerry Springer's driving around Sarasota, Florida in a convertible Maserati.
And they say, how can he still have a license at his age?
Oh, please. I'm sure you're just a kid in Sarasota.
That's true. It's true. We've lived there 17 years or whatever. So when we first got there, we said, gosh, everyone here is so old. And now we go out to dinner and we say, God, everyone here is so young. Because now we're up.
Why did you move to Sarasota?
We wanted to – I was doing the show in Chicago.
Tax evasion.
We were living in Cincinnati then, actually. And I was doing the show in Chicago, but our home was Cincinnati. And then we were looking for – I wanted to live near the water. So we looked at California first. But you couldn't get back to Chicago in time to do the show on weekend. I mean, it was just too long a flight. So then we looked at the East Coast and turned to Florida because it was always warm. And Sarasota's a cool community now. I mean, it really is. I love it. I would never move. Late to move.
You're now, this is
you're not that old.
Oh, gosh. I remember when Lincoln was shot, they canceled classes. It was horrible.
You're not in a community, are you? You're like in a house, I assume.
Yes, I'm not in a community.
Well, I would love to be in a community. You're at an age similar to. No, but
No, we live on the water. No, actually, it's really cool. And actually, it's getting to be a pretty young town just because so much business has moved in, young. Yuppies or whatever you used to call them. But anyway, it's kind of cool.
We pretty much only know Florida here as the state from which all sorts of crazy news stories come.
Well, exactly. And I'm, politics is my real passion. And here I was living in Ohio, Cincinnati all these years. And then now we live in Florida. And the two states that screw up every presidential election, Ohio and Florida, we can't count.
I should have looked into this. I almost remember this from memory. You were mayor of Cincinnati.
I was mayor of Cincinnati.
How long were you mayor for?
Two terms.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
that was great.
Yeah. What happened? Oh, we all know what happened.
No, actually, you don't.
I don't.
I wish I
I only know the tabloid version.
Yeah, but that was before I ever became mayor. I mean, that was well before I ever became mayor.
Okay, what happened then?
So after I became mayor, I was hired by NBC to anchor Cincinnati News. They figured if you've been mayor, you really know the town.
Yeah,
so,
of course.
And they were looking for a news anchor, so I just decided, well, I'll do that for a little bit. And I did that for 10 years, and we became pretty dominant. And the company that owned the station where I do the news also owned talk shows, Phil Donahue, Sally Jesse Raphael. So they took me to lunch one day, said, Phil's retiring. You're going to host a new talk show. And that's how it happened.
And how long did that run for?
We're still doing it. We're in our 23rd year.
Wow.
Yeah, we're on twice a day.
That's crazy.
Even
I remember early on, I was probably 13 or 14 minute when it debuted. I remember being fascinated by it because you had the most interesting human interest guests in those first couple of years. I remember one day I came home from school and there were conjoined twins, adult conjoined twins at the head.
Yeah,
and to a 14-year-old or 13 or whatever I was.
Lori and Dory.
Blew my goddamn mind. That's right, it was. I recorded it on VCR tape and showed it to my parents later that night. I'm like, you're not going to believe it was on TV.
It started off as a pretty serious show and then we went stupid about 3 years in.
Whose decision was that?
Mine, but not to go stupid. Actually, the real answer to the question is there were 20 talk shows at the time, all trying to be like Oprah, appealing to the demographic, which at that time was referred to as middle-aged housewives. And then along came Ricky Lake, and she really was the first show to go after kids. And when I say kids, I mean high school and college age. And so one day I'm walking down Michigan Avenue in Chicago with the executive producer, and I say, just as a business model, why are we trying to be one out of 20 shows going after Oprah's audience? Let's just be one out of two, go after Ricky's audience, and let's just have young people. So that meant young people on stage, young people in the audience, young subject matter. Well, as you know, young people are much wilder and much more open about their lives, and so the show started to go crazy once in a while. Then Universal bought us, NBC Universal, and said from now on you can only do crazy. So that's in our contract
now. I remember there was a shift from the guests. They were sort of more human interest, bizarre type guests to
Now we've got – I mean we had this guy who married his horse. But we did a
– Did you also have the horse?
Yes.
You got to get both sides of the story.
Oh, yeah. Pixel came out. Because, you know, we had had so much fighting going on. So one day I started the show and said, you know, there's been all this fighting. I think it's time for a love story. So the audience is going, oh, because they're there to see all the action.
Craziness.
So and so I said, OK, here's Bob. And Bob is sitting there on the chair on stage, you know, and I said, Bob, he's about a 40-year-old man. I said, Bob, what's going on? He says, well, I'm having trouble with the neighbors. No one likes my wife. I said, what's that? Does she cause any trouble? No, she keeps to herself. She's quiet.
She's vegetarian?
Yeah, whatever. And I said, okay. Now, mind you, I'm never allowed to know what the show's about.
Really?
Yeah.
You go out there blind?
Yeah. They hand me this card, which you see me carrying around, but the card just has the names of the guests. And then my job is to ask questions that you would ask sitting at home watching and then make jokes. But I'm not allowed to know what the subject matter is.
It's almost like 20 questions.
Yeah. So I go out there and I say, Bob, so what's going on? And he tells me, you know, he's got people don't like his wife. I said, well, okay. And then I look at the next name in the card. It says Pixel. Here's Pixel. And out comes this horse. The crowd goes crazy. Oh, and thanks for great sound effect. Good. Okay. Yeah. How many times have you had to use that one?
Very rarely.
I've never ever heard that one. Yeah. Speaking of, do you have a top drop?
Oh, I think I have some stuff from yesterday. Aisha Tyler was our guest yesterday, and she said,
also, I love Dick.
That's what Aisha Tyler says.
How long has she liked the former vice president?
Also, I love Dick.
Quite a long time. Yeah,
so, her whole life.
Lifelong love affair.
So Pixel comes out. So crowd goes wild.
The crowd goes crazy. And now I'm stymied because I don't have that many horse jokes. So
you're racking your brain for horse material.
Come just on. Just wide, the long face.
I did use that.
What's my horse chunk?
So anyway, but here's what was weird. One additional weird thing was every time I stood between Bob, who was sitting down, and Pixel, in between them. In other words, there's the picture.
Oh.
There you go.
You can see that on adamcarolla.com. What is he holding?
A stick.
Like a riding crop?
Yeah. And
a sex toy.
Here's the deal. It was... Pixel would nudge me out of the way. Pixel always wanted to have Bob
jealous lover
in line of sight. It was really, I mean, it was unsettling to say the least. But just so you know that I have some moral compass, you know, at the end of the show when I do my final thought, I came out against the marriage. Now, we did a follow-up show, just so you know that we care about, I guess, because Pixel left him.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Like
we always try to show that show around the Kentucky Derby because we want horse lovers to start tuning in.
Sure.
Well, wait. So why did you come out against it? Because there's a lot of thought about bestiality and why it is or isn't okay. And, I mean, the argument against it, aside from the ick factor, is that an animal can't truly give consent, right?
Yeah, that's one argument against it. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, that's true. That is against it. There is the ick. There's, for many people, the biblical problem with it. Mm-hmm. And also the law.
There's that.
So there's that. I mean, I could think, you know, if you have a kid and your kid comes home and says, Dad, I'm dating a horse, you know, I've heard of people, you know, that's wrong. That's wrong. Let's. Okay, this. I'm supposed to be the host, not the guest. I feel
but
bad.
But you're fascinating.
You've lived.
I know we have so many questions
life.
For
go
you.
Go ahead. Most of fire away. Am I interfering with your regulation?
No.
No. Okay, go ahead.
Interfering. Yes. You are not only hosting it, but you're also making it amazing. Okay. So I want to know. Do you find yourself, you know, getting angry at the guests, or like,
no.
Where do your emotions come into it?
They don't. On a serious note, I like most of the people on the show. Not all. I mean, some, you know, if we have neo-Nazis on, obviously I don't. But I mean, normally, you know, there's no difference. We're all the same. End of subject. We are all the same. Some of us just dress better. Some of us had better luck in the gene pool of parents. You know, some of us were born with a better brain and therefore maybe got a better education and whatever. But every person I've ever had on the show, they all want to be happy. They all get upset when they're not. Their language isn't as, you know, advanced maybe as ours. If you went to college and all that, you can use fancier terms. You can be passive aggressive, where all they can use is the F word and then and then swing out. But they're no different. When the show is over, I'm telling you, 95% of them, oh, Jerry, can we have a picture? What's a good restaurant to go here? Will you hold my kid? Well, we're all the same, you know, and so I, as I said, I don't get angry at the people. They sometimes do stupid things. We've all done stupid things. It doesn't make us a bad person. It means at a particular moment in life, you did something you probably shouldn't have done. And that's all. So, yeah, no, I don't get angry. And I don't know these people as well, you know, so it's hard for me to be invested.
I'm casting my memory back now to the early to mid 90s, and much like there was the judge show boom, there was the talk show boom, the midday talk shows, and there was some character named Gordon Elliott, and there was Ricky Lake, and there was Jenny Jones, and Geraldo, and everyone. You must have come in contact with most, if not all, of the other hosts.
We're the longest running show on television.
The Survivor
talk shows, yeah.
But of those other hosts, who surprisingly would anyone have surprised us in ones that were easy to get along with? Because they all seemed like sociopaths.
No, I don't have any bad. First of all, I don't know any celebrities. I mean, I meet them. Mm-hmm. You know, like at conventions, it's like I know Adam. But it's
we not, said celebrities.
Yeah. Okay. But I mean, it's like I'll meet them because we're at a function together or I'm on a show with them or whatever. But I don't live in Hollywood. You know, so I don't know any of these people personally other than when I meet them in a professional capacity. And they're nothing but nice to me, you know. So I don't have a bad story. I don't have any, oh, you should see this. I just don't hang with them. And, you know, my friends are the same friends I grew up with, that kind of thing. So I lead a really, really normal life. But I just happen to get paid for doing a job on television. But otherwise, there's nothing particular.
Funny also for the guy who hosts the wacky show to lead such a normal life.
I think that's why the show works, frankly. If you got a young-looking hunk doing the show, I don't think the show would work. Because it's basically young people, and all the young people say, well, I'm better looking than him, and I'm cooler than him. And
well,
all
don't
that,
sell yourself short, Jerry. Yeah, you were a pretty young-looking hunk back in the day.
Yeah, never. So, but with me, I'm not threatening. You know, I'm like the teacher they had.
Avuncular.
It's like, you know, there's Jerry. He's not taking my girl. He's not going to challenge me to a fight. I'm just this old guy who's – and I think – because there's such craziness, and I'm standing there in a suit, it's like if these people walked into your home and your parents were there, you'd be, you know, many people, you'd be kind of embarrassed what they're saying and how they're going to react. And then when they see that I don't explode, and I don't curse. So it's not, I don't live that lifestyle, but it's awfully interesting to be there. I think that's why it works.
It's disarming.
How do you realize that the right formula is for you to not know anything about the guests ahead of time?
It's called the Adam Carolla formula.
Well, because I wasn't an actor, I said to them, don't tell me what's going to happen because then I'm going to have to pretend to be surprised. I mean, it was that simple. It wasn't something I sat down and thought about. It was the very first day. I say, I don't want to know. Let me ask questions because, okay, I think I'm reasonably bright. So I'll know what to ask. You know, I'll ask a question that if I were watching at home, what I'd want to know, and I'll think of some jokes then. But I really don't want to know. I don't know what I'm doing here. Who are you?
I'm Allison. That's Brian.
Plus, the natural reaction is good for the camera to catch, too. You know, your natural reaction.
Absolutely. It, the one magic formula of television, whatever you do, is authenticity. If you think of the biggest stars on television, they're not the best-looking people necessarily, you know, other than movie stars or singers. Usually, it's something that just comes across, or someone who comes across as totally authentic. Hmm. They can have a speech impediment. They can look a little bit weird. But those are the superstars over time. It's because it's authentic. It's real. If I try and be cool, it's never going to work. So I don't get a lot of what, you know, the young people are talking about, or when they're going into hip hop and all that, and I'm getting all the technology wrong, and I finally figured out Facebook. You know, here, hey, take a look at my phone.
You sound like a guy from Sarasota, Florida.
Yeah.
Huh? Huh? Wow.
First of all, it's a clamshell.
Yeah. There you go.
It's a flip phone.
A flip phone.
Yeah.
Now, here's the advantage of the flip phone. I don't care how many things you want to have, all these iPhones and everything. Let me tell you about the flip phone. You can tell when the call is over.
Okay.
And haven't there been moments you wish you would have known? When you hang up, you hang up. You get an iPhone. You don't know if you've really hung up.
You're pressing buttons. You're pressing the screen.
Music breaks out. I'm on the elevator. I check into a hotel, and all of a sudden, I have weird musical tastes. And it's like really old-time country, just, you know, absurd. Everyone would laugh at my musical tastes. So all of a sudden, I'm checking into the hotel, and suddenly I hear, oh, man, Patti Page singing the Tennessee Waltz. This is great. Now I go to I get on the elevator.
And it follows you.
I'm saying, oh, this is great. They got on the elevator. Now when I'm going down the hall, I figure this is crazy.
I realize
it's coming out of my pocket. And all these people were listening to the Tennessee Waltz. Let's talk about your book.
I have a book coming out.
I want to hear about it.
I worked very hard on it, and I'm very nervous about it. Have you written a book? Or have you
Not really.
Anything come out that you're nervous about the success or reception of?
Getting up in the morning makes me nervous.
Equally.
Yeah. It's a mirror is what makes me nervous. But no, tell me about your book, because that's a serious book, and people ought to hear about it.
Thanks.
And they ought to buy it.
Thanks. It's called Shrinkage,
yes.
And it is subtitled Manhood, Marriage, and the Tumor That Tried to Kill Me. I was diagnosed with a brain tumor 5 years ago yesterday.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
My five-year anniversary was yesterday, and
God bless you.
Thank you so much.
And no kidding.
In the cancer world, you know, 5 years is a big deal.
Yes,
you survived five years, and you're doing pretty good.
Damn it, that's great news.
Thanks.
Care anything else we talk about today. That's the best news I've heard all day.
Thanks, Jerry.
God bless you.
No one's happier than me.
Yeah.
But so I wrote a book about it, and I'm really proud of it, and I hope people enjoy it, and I hope it helps people. But just for a fun little thing, you know, we recorded an audiobook because fans of our show are obviously into spoken entertainment.
Yeah.
And just for a fun little thing, we animated a scene from the book. And if you'd like to hear a clip,
let's do it right now.
You know, I'll do a little setup. This is from the chapter titled Our Honeymoon, or The Time My Wife Drugged Me in a Kid's Pool in Maui. This takes place just after I finished radiation and chemotherapy. The Time My Wife Drugged Me in a Kid's Pool in Maui. We were more than halfway into our honeymoon, but still hadn't gone to the swim-up bar, even though I could see it from our hotel room. There it was, taunting me from 5 stories away. I was like a kid who could see the Matterhorn's Peak from the Fleabag motel his parents rented next to Disneyland. Every moment spent looking at it was a moment we weren't there. "Let's do this already," I yelled to Christy. In their infinite wisdom, the hotel had put their swim-up bar in the same pool where kids lined up to get on the hotel's water slide. Why the hell would you put your swim-up bar in what was essentially a kiddie pool? No matter. It was time to get our soggy drink on.
100% true, by the way.
We made our way down to the pool. Actually, Christy made the way for both of us. Kicked off our flip-flops and jumped, fell, in. We waded up to the bar and ordered a couple of drinks. Then a couple more. It was everything I had hoped for. Good beer, relaxing atmosphere, and you never had to get up to pee, if you know what I mean. We were at the bar longer than we anticipated, so it became time to take my afternoon dose of steroids. Luckily, Christy, being the wonderful wife she is, had brought along all my potential pills in a plastic baggie. "Steroid time," she said, and fished out a pill. I downed it with a beer. After another 45 minutes or so of just hanging out and enjoying the view from the bar, we decided to leave. Christy said, "I'm going to get out and grab our flip-flops from the other side of the pool. I'll meet you on the other side, by the steps." She jumped out of the pool, and I finished my beer.
I slid off the bar stool and was shocked by a sudden feeling of extreme tipsiness, much more than I anticipated. I felt wasted. I'd only had a couple of beers, but things have been changing so frequently with my physical condition lately that I figured, well, this is just the next thing to go, so my mission became to get out of the pool without hurting myself. Christy was standing on the side of the pool with all of our dry belongings in her hands. Rather than have her put them all back down and re-enter the pool just to humiliatingly help me out of it, I decided to make a go of it. But there was one problem. The kids. I had to negotiate a pool full of kids to make it to the other side. Sloppily, I waded through them. Keep in mind, I felt bombed. I was like Will Ferrell in Old School.
I like you, but you're crazy.
I was slurring my words and pushing kids out of the way. Some of the other adults were giving me what-the-hell-is-he-doing look, more than once, I might add. While watching this grotesque display, Christy hissed at me from the side of the pool. Ryan, you've got to maintain. I pulled myself together and waded the final 10 feet to the stairs, where Christy helped me out of the pool. We went upstairs to our room, and I immediately passed out for 2 hours. The next day, we went to a different pool at the hotel so as not to be recognized as the couple who got wasted at the bar and stumbled into all those kids. When it was time for my morning dose of steroids, Christy pulled out our bag of pills and began to fish one out. With a confused look on her face, she paused. "What's up?" I asked. "There are still 2 steroid pills in here," she said. "So, give me one of them." "I put 2 in the baggie yesterday before the pool. There should only be 1 left." She did a little more digging around in the pill bag. "But you know what? One of my Valiums is missing." And that was the time my wife drugged me in a kid's pool in Maui.
100% true story. And, yeah, it's an animation. It's on YouTube. We can link to it from adamcarolla.com. But it's from the audiobook, and I hope the whole book is kind of like that. It's serious, but it's kind of funny and irreverent and just stories that happen to
when
me.
When did you start writing it? I mean, how long?
I turned the book. I wrote it over the course of about 5 months, and I turned it
When did you start? In other words, how long in the process were you before you
started? About, let's say, New Year's 2013. So I started around Christmas, New Year's 2013, and finished in May. I turned the book in a year ago, May 2013. So it seems like forever ago, and it's coming out in a couple of days.
How soon after you found out what you had did you decide, gee, I'm going to write a book about this?
Oh, not till well after the fact. I mean, for the time that I was going through radiation and chemotherapy, I was pretty messed up. I mean, I was using a walker full time. I'm sure Dawson remembers, some of the guys here remember. I was using a walker full time, and I was even in a wheelchair at a short point.
And I don't know if Jerry knows, but your prognosis was not hopeful in the beginning.
Upon diagnosis, I was told flat out that in most cases like mine, they say 6 to 12 months.
Oh. That's actually how I met you.
Was it? Through the event?
It was after the event, actually. I started working here a little after that, but I met you in a very impaired state.
Oh, wow, that's crazy.
For lack of a better term. So I've gotten to watch you grow into this. So I don't have the baseline like Dawson does from the radio show.
But, that's nuts. Yeah. But Dawson saw me go up and down and up again.
Yeah, I saw you get really ugly.
Bad times.
And you never really
he's not that good looking now, let's be honest.
Although the animation of you... quite statuesque.
Yeah, who did that? So, how much did you pay that?
Yeah, Christy's looking.
I know.
Yeah,
quite enhanced there.
This fellow named James animated it, and he did a great job, and did a little test animation about 10 seconds long, and I'm this bulked up Adonis, and I'm like, well, maybe scale it back a little bit. And he said, to his credit, he's like, "Hey, it's your animation. We make you look as good as possible."
I got to hire this guy. This is great.
But it's funny that Gary met me so long ago when I was doing so poorly back then. And one of the points I try to make in the book is for anyone who's recovering from any kind of serious anything, cancer or illness or whatever, recovery is so incremental. You don't even notice it day to day, but you've put some distance between you and the condition, and you're like, wow, I've kind of come a long way.
Yeah. I can't even pretend to know what you went through, and it's amazing. I'm in awe.
Thank you. Like I said, no one's happier than me to still be here.
I also want to tell you that that's the first time I've heard any of the audiobook, and it's so good. You really brought it to life.
Oh,
was
thanks.
That difficult in the booth to not just kind of read it?
It was, because I'm not really much of an actor, obviously, but I read it, and I had to go over a few of the lines a couple times.
There's
and then,
someone in there, or through a headset saying, do it again.
Correct. It'd be like I was sitting where, Gary or Dawson sitting, and everyone else is here. But what happened a couple times, the end of the book, it gets kind of emotional. There's some emotional points, and I actually got choked up a couple times.
Well, sure.
And had to kind of straighten that out.
You're entitled to any kind of emotion you want to have.
But there was obviously very good emotion, too, because, spoiler alert, I'm still here.
Yeah, spoiled.
The hero lives in the end.
Okay. Hey, anyway, we're gonna take a break.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, what do people do in a break?
Pee.
Okay.
Well, that's what we do. The
listeners. I'll be back, and I'll weigh less than I do now.
All right, there was Jerry in 2014 hosting the show in place of Adam. Truly a one-time only thing, but very interesting and a very fun dynamic with Allison and Brian. All right, coming up next for the final clip today, Adam Carolla Show, 1708, Jerry Springer, Nate Adams, Jeff Abraham, Dr. Scott Sadlin, Gina Gratt, and Brian Bishop. This one's from November of 2015. Hope you enjoy.
Jerry Springer, who I just got done interviewing for Take a Knee, I found incredibly... Oh, thanks, Dawson. Did you do something?
I'm doing all kinds of things over here.
I love about you. Jerry Springer I found fascinating. Fascinating.
Well, you're about to find him fascinating again.
Love this man.
He guest-hosted when you were, I think, Celebrity Apprentice,
yes.
Maybe?
Mm-hmm.
You were away for something.
Yes. You know me, probably just stretching out in the sun, tanning my tootsies.
Taking some time.
Take a little cat nap.
Taking some A-time.
Yep. Jerry Springer in here.
Please, don't get up.
I just was enthralled with Jerry. Of course, the TV show, Jerry Springer Show. Check your local listings because it's syndicated. It's all different times, different places all over the country. Celebrating its 25th year. That is pretty rarefied air. Also, the podcast, the Jerry Springer podcast, new episodes every Tuesday on iTunes. Jerry, as I was speaking to and being infinitely fascinated by, he was telling me, born in England, born during the Blitz.
Wow.
In 1944, born in the subway system, bomb shelter, essentially.
Wow.
In 1944, and immigrated at age 5 to New York
you
and everything else.
You memorized this stuff. You are good.
Anything that's fascinating,
yeah.
I remember.
Yeah.
You're talking to Adam Prep Carolla.
Yeah.
Maybe you haven't heard.
Yeah.
And was talking about his Jewish-German family and just what happened to them during the Holocaust, which I had no idea about. And I wouldn't mind, if you wouldn't mind, retelling that story now that you told me just moments earlier.
Yeah, my family, like millions of others, we were German Jews, and my dad was born in a town called Landsberg, which is northwestern Germany, and now is Poland. And my mom was born in Berlin. And anyway, when the Nazis came to power, my parents got married in 1933, actually. They got married 2 months after Hitler came to power. But there was already major discrimination against the Jews. And they got married in a private home with the shades drawn, they didn't want to draw attention. In any event, they had a shoe store. And over the next few years, all of a sudden laws were passed where you weren't allowed to buy from Jewish merchants. Mm. And one of the crazier laws was Jews weren't allowed to own pets. Their property was taken from them. I mean, just crazy stuff like that, but also very – and, you know, they couldn't make a living because they would throw rocks through the windows of their shoe store. They put swastikas up. Finally, it got too tough for my dad, so he moved to Berlin.
After all that, it got too tough.
Yeah, well, he and my mom moved to Berlin figuring – because Landsberg was a small town, and they thought living in Berlin, a major metropolitan area, somehow there would be safety in numbers, but –
So it was it also kind of a we're living in German Kentucky and we want to move to Manhattan
right.
or L.A.
Yes.
where people are more progressive, like, you're a gay couple 20 years ago.
Yes.
Let's live in Venice Beach and not get judged here. But that didn't happen.
That didn't happen. And then night times, because I have a cousin who is still alive. She's living in New York and she's like 83, 84 years old now. And she was 11 years old at the time when she left Germany. She left in 38. But she tells the times there in Berlin where at night, for example, she was sent to live with the aunt because where the men were there, the stormtrooper, the SS, would come at night, bang on your door, and grab the men and take them away. And they didn't want Erica to have to see that. She's just a young girl. And so there was fear every night by the late 30s. Kristallnacht was November of 1938. And that's really when the world started to hear about what was happening to the Jews there. And so it became incredibly scary.
By the way, can I just say this?
Yeah.
The worst and most tasteless porn name ever.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's up there or down there.
She spells it differently, but it's still distracting.
Very inappropriate.
So your parents.
So that was the environment they were in.
They get out on some of the last visas out.
I mean, they get out in August of 39, the first week in August, they finally get a visa, which gets them out. They wanted to come to America. They couldn't get a visa to America because there were quota systems. And someone signed for them a visa which would get them to England. And the person's name was Goldberg. But they never knew who Goldberg was. It probably was an agency in London, World Jewish Relief, that would sign these papers and saying, oh, it's a family member, because you had to have a sponsor in order to be able to be admitted into the country. So this person, Goldberg, whoever was the person that signed that, signed the document. Mom and Dad got out in the first week of August of 39. 3.5 weeks later, September 1st of 39, Hitler goes into Poland to start World War II. The gates come down. Jews aren't let out anymore. A month later, my sister is born. And so when my mom escaped, she was pregnant at the time. I was born during the war, as we said, in the subway stop. But they didn't speak English at the time. My dad was put to work making sewing uniforms for the English British soldiers. And he was an air raid warden, and he would stand on top of the buildings there. We lived in Hampstead in England, in London, and he would stand there and he would blow the whistle. And when the bombs came down, you know, he would blow the whistle there. And he says it was awful because, one, obviously you saw the bombs coming. You hoped to God it wouldn't hit your house, but you felt terrible because if it didn't hit your apartment complex, it hit the one next door.
It had to be a weird... If there was a small sort of crystal ball, it had to be weird saying to your parents, like, good news, you know, circa 1939, you're out of Germany. Bad news is you're going to a place that's going to be bombed by Germany.
Yeah.
So well, it's like you get out at this place and into the place that's on the receiving end of the bombs of Germany.
Yeah, if you think about it, they had, you know, for hundreds of years, they had been good German citizens, German Jews, but that was their life and that's all they knew. And now you figure 1939, Dad he was born 04, so he was 35. My mom was 33. So at that age, 33 and 35, all of a sudden, overnight, you're taken out of the country. You run out of the country. You'll never see your family again. And you wind up in another country where they don't speak your language. And it's like, imagine what that must be like, just knowing, you know, that you know nothing about what your future is going to be. They don't have a livelihood. They don't have a penny. And this is just their story. I mean, there were millions like that. And that is why even today I get upset when I hear about our attitude towards immigrants here in America. You know, you don't know what it's like running for your life. And you know, please, someplace, put me up. You know, and the people that are coming over here, 99.9999% of them have never touched a bomb. They're not terrorists. They just happen to live in a country where there's some horrible people that have done some bad stuff. And now they're just going, trying to find any place that they can get, you know, a living. We've got to understand what that must be like. Imagine if it was you and your kids. Wouldn't you do anything you could to try to find a place that you can live?
Not my parents, but I would. My parents stay here and burn. Yeah. But I would take my kids out. They're innocent for now. Yeah. For now.
See how they do.
Gina's got a question which I want to hear. I definitely want to hear the very grim story of what happened to then your parents, and you know, other family members, because this is again, you know how I want to bomb Germany again. This will make you want to join
make
me.
Case for
Start
you.
Over.
Yes, go ahead, Gina.
Well, you know, you just said about welcoming refugees and immigrants, and my first question about that was, do you know how your parents were treated in a new country in terms of just the overall feeling? Were people welcoming? Was anyone helpful? Did they feel shunned?
Actually, they had a very good feeling. I mean, the people of London, I mean, the people around them, they were, we lived in a four-story, we call it apartment complex, they call it flats, in a four-story flat, and virtually all the people in that flat were immigrants. Mm-hmm. So they were in that kind of community. Plus, the Jewish community was very active then in trying to save, you know, the Jews from other countries. So they would make you feel at home. So my parents always said, I mean, you know, we're Anglophiles. You know, England was great to us. So I can never have a bad word to say about what they did. And then, of course, once we came to America, you know, my parents believe in the they're no longer living, but they believed in the Statue of Liberty. We were the immigrant story. You know, you see all these movies about the immigrants. We lived that story going from nothing. You know, look at my life. I mean, from in one generation, we went from extermination to this ridiculously privileged life I live today because of a stupid TV show. So I know America works. You know, it can work.
I was thinking during the Blitzkrieg, had to be like the only time
it wasn't
people...
formally, I should say that it wasn't formally the Blitz, because the Blitz was a couple of years earlier, but there was bombing.
Well, yeah, let's say, let's say a dusting of bombs.
Yes.
It had to be one of the only
quibble over the
times, only times in real estate history where a rock, paper, scissor game took place over who got the basement. Why do I always have the penthouse? Why can't you take the penthouse? No, not so fast.
And maybe we could dig another hole next to the basement.
I got here first. Yeah. I want to be down where the sewer line is with no windows. You be up top with your sun decks and your girls with their bikinis. That had to be like the only moment in time where there was a discussion.
Get lower.
Yeah. Look, you want to go up top? We can do that for about £30 a month. You want the basement? Now that's going to cost you.
How much you got?
We got candy spelling down there now.
Yeah.
That's some rarefied non-air. That's some pretty dank good air down there.
Dank.
Want to breathe dank air again? Big arguments over who got the basement.
Yeah.
All right. So then your parents, I'm sorry, your parents' parents.
Yeah.
This is a sort of just horrifying story that Jerry was telling me during Take a Knee. Oh, well, Gary, don't show the picture of the truck that Jerry's going to describe. But your parents' parents. And by the way, the Germans were... insane, crazed killers and everything, but they weren't stupid. Like, if you were elderly or maybe too young or too old, or you had a bad leg or bad wheel, they didn't really need you. But if you were, you know, 19 and strapping, they'd put you to work. Right. And then not feed you. You die of dysentery or something. The Japanese were the same way. They'll put you to work until you die, but they're not going to throw out a bunch of good labor. So... that's the way that kind of ran things in World War II in general. So, like, if you were, you know, young and strong and a dude, you were actually, you know, that sort of women and children first or elderly, whatever. It's just sort of the opposite.
It was
it's
backwards.
Like
exactly.
Who we could use to bust some rock up and make a tunnel through this mountain.
Right.
So, sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. So, they, well, what they did is, you know, the Nazis would come and bang on your door, you know, and break in or whatever, and they would grab the men or whatever. Eventually, they grabbed the other people, and, you know, they got my grandmothers, both grandmothers, and they got my uncles and aunts and cousins, a whole bunch of them. And they took them away. And the records that the BBC was able to find with a show called Who Do You Think You Are? And the records are available now. And they
Which came out here, but started off there.
It started off in England. They did the show on me, on Who Do You Think You Are? And they go back, they went back three centuries to find my family all the way back to 1773. Wow. So they traced it.
Awesome.
But in tracing back my family, they found the records of the people that have, you know, were exterminated.
Were you guys in Germany in 1773?
Yes.
God, it makes it that much more of a atrocity slash insult. Like, we've been here for a couple hundred, I mean, 170 years. Yeah. Where are we going?
Yeah, exactly. And so that was another thing. It's like your country, which you've been so patriotic about, has turned on you. So obviously there must have been that feeling as well. But when they took my grandmother's, for example, they first took her to a ghetto in Poland. It was called Łódź. And they were piled into – they showed us the rooms, actually. They were piled into a room of 12 people, and it was a room a third of the size of this studio here. And the rooms had no heat, no running water, no electricity. It was literally just a darkened a closet. And they and if you had to go to the bathroom, you went out on the street, and you defecated there or whatever, and then – And they were fed every third day, and you know a lot of people died there. My grandmother, my mom's mom, survived that. But after being there for 6 months, they came and they put her in on a train, and the train and they had the number of the car, and the train took them to Chełmno. They were told that you're going to Chełmno. Because these conditions where you're living now are awful, and you know we built some good housing, and you're going to be segregated, but it'll be better conditions.
You know what's weird? The Germans kept documents of all this stuff,
and that is the one. It's funny you mention that. It is one of the most. The thing that really got me going emotionally was looking at the handwriting. It was perfect penmanship because they weren't typing it; they were print. You know they. And they had the records. They had your grandmother's name, what day she was fed what car number she went on. And so I know the exact day and time that she was exterminated.
It's such a bizarre cultural thing.
Like they're cataloging grain or cattle or something. Right.
The reason they did the records, though, which was explained to me, is the Nazis didn't trust their own people. Their own soldiers.
And they might be overtaken by sympathy.
Well, they wanted to make sure everything had to be accounted for because they took all your jewelry. They took all your clothing. They took everything you had.
Dipping in the till.
Right. They didn't want people taking, you know, stuff for themselves. So everything they took had to be written down. So they had when they took, you know, and they had exactly. She had one pair of underwear, one pair of the stockings. She had one dress, a pair. I mean, it was, you know, how many shoes she had, what color the shoes were, where they were taken.
But it's funny, too, not funny, haha, but it's a cultural thing as well. Like, I know from digging 1960s Lamborghinis that when you talk to a lot of guys, they're like, yeah, they didn't really keep records on a lot of the stuff they had. Like, Lamborghini wasn't really good at that, which car was built when or what had what engine or whatever in it. And it was like,
the seat of his pants.
Wasn't kind of, even now we're in the mid-late 60s, the guy's building cars, it didn't really keep good records because they're Italians. They were drinking wine at, you know, noon and fucking by one that same afternoon. Yeah. So it's weird that the Germans, with this kind of weird cultural thing, made them so much more efficient and exterminating. Yeah. Whereas this wouldn't have worked too close to the equator. It's not like the Jamaicans around, let's get hot.
You're saying the Italians would have fucked up the Holocaust?
They would have tried. Like, I think their hearts would have been in the wrong place, but I don't think they would have been able to pull it off.
Well, and it also makes Holocaust deniers seem that much dumber. It's like, what are you talking about? They kept their own records.
Yes, actually, that's a good point. They kept their own records.
Look, you know, do the stuff with the Big Bang and Jesus and how old the Earth is and all that kind of stuff and argue with carbon dating, but they're taking tours of Auschwitz. Yeah. You know what I mean? There's buildings.
Or there's physical evidence.
Right. Yeah. So anyway.
So they took my mom's mom to this place, Chełmno. And Chełmno, as I told Adam before, it was a death camp. So you only there from 24 to 36 hours. And it was this big, at the time, beautiful mansion on the outside. And the Nazi soldiers there were all dressed in white doctor's garbs. They looked like doctors. They didn't carry – you didn't see the guns or anything because they didn't want the people panicking coming off and starting a riot coming off the trains. So they were told, you're being taken here because you're going to get a medical checkup, and then we're going to give you some nice housing. And, you know, you've been in horrible conditions. We recognize that it's going to improve. So you were hopeful. You must always have been hopeful. You know, I mean, can you imagine? They grabbed at anything.
Well, and I think anybody, whether you're in prison for not killing the person you're accused of being, you know, doing life for, I think when the guard or the warden comes walking down the hall, you must be thinking, good.
Yeah.
They're finally going to realize they got the wrong guy.
Yeah.
We didn't do anything.
Yep.
You know, I mean, no greater example than the Jews. Your dad's trying to run a business and pay some taxes, and all of a sudden the windows are breaking. But finally, like, someone has come to their senses. We've been, our family's been here for 155 years.
Yes. And they're probably thinking, the people there were thinking, oh, this is good. Oh, look, it is a beautiful, didn't look like a prison. And when I went there, it looked like a beautiful home. But when you went inside, then you went down in the basement, they said, you know, we're going to, you know, give us your clothing. And again, they wrote down everything they had. Here's your bag. You're going to collect it when you, but first we're going to clean it for you. In the meantime, and you're going to go take a shower or whatever. So you walk down the basement hallway, and then this door opened, and the door opened into the back of a van. And the van held about 75 people. I think I have that number correctly. Maybe it was less. But anyway, they packed you in there naked, shut the door, which was then pitch black in there, and they poured the gas in. And then the van took you about 15, 20 minutes away to this field, which became the mass grave. You were dead by the time you reached the field because of the gas. So people would just start screaming and then die slowly. And then they and they had the date that it happened, and this was with everyone. My dad's mom was exterminated at a place called Theresienstadt. And Theresienstadt is where they did medical experiments, and there they had the records of what medical experiments they did. And you can imagine, because they were – my grandparents were at that point in their 60s. So they had lived this whole life in a very cultured – I mean, talk about – this was not some – not that it would make a difference in terms of the morality of it. This wasn't a third world country. This was perhaps the most cultured society on the planet. Great music, great literature. I mean, just great art. I mean, you know, this was a great culture that they came from. You know, we studied them in school here in America.
And I mean, you have
they had
to...
this life, and now all of a sudden, imagine waking up in the morning to the extent that you could sleep at night. This, what a night. This is real. They're really doing this to us.
God. And I mean, they probably had a Mercedes-Benz or Auto Union or something. They used to call Audi was Auto Union back in the day. But it had to be. And again, I think the important, you see a lot of grainy black and white film of this stuff, and it always just looks like some weird world that's a thousand, not even this planet. Forget about this time period, you know, just a million years ago in some galaxy far, far away. But what I like to do is say, how old were your parents at the time? How old were your grandparents at the time? How old was the uncle at the time? And then think to yourself, geez, I remember when I was...
Put yourself in that spot.
I was 35. I was working on the Man Show with Jimmy. What?
Yeah.
What if someone had marched into the office and said, no more fart jokes?
Oh, wow.
I mean, imagine...
The talk about a crystal
mouth.
Crystal fart.
I just... What I'm saying is, you put yourself at that age, or put yourself at the age of, you know, it's 10 years from now, and I'm thinking about retiring, and I'm planning, oh, no, you're not. We're taking your house. We're taking everything you've earned. We're taking it all, and you and your wife are going off.
Another thing, you Adam, have a thing about nomenclature when it's, you know, I'm a victim of this versus a survivor of this or whatever. And people often apply a term to sort of elicit a response or whatever it is. It's funny that, you know, Jerry and a lot of people say, you know, your grandmother was exterminated. Your grandmother was murdered. Like, that's, if you, you know, you can put it in terms that are a little more blunt, like, grandmother fucking murdered.
Yeah.
It's insane. I mean, I don't mean to make you feel bad, but I'm saying it's crazy to think
it's
of it that
tortured
way.
And then murdered.
That's insane. Yeah.
And the mental torture must have been unbelievable until the physical torture came.
Well,
but the mental torture went on for, you know, it wasn't like one night they broke in.
You're tormented.
Boom, tormented for months. And the fear was for years. You always worried, is this the night they're going to, you know, anytime you heard footsteps outside in your apartment building, you're going, oh, diesel.
I want to get a quick plug in for Jerry. He's out here. He's going to be at Knott's Berry Farm playing the Good Time Theater.
Oh.
He has a Dixieland band.
Yeah.
And anyway, let's get back. I'm sorry.
Let's go live it up.
So Straw Hat and the Bow Ties are going to be at Knott's Berry Farm. That'll be this Saturday. Yeah. Anyway, let's get back to Extermination of the Grandparents. I'm sorry, I just wanted to jump in. I go too long without a plug.
You know, it's also interesting. You named two camps, or you know, that I've never heard of. Like growing up in Hebrew school and high school and doing all these things.
I had never heard of Helamo.
Yes, studying it so diligently, and these are two names I've never heard.
Well, Helamo, very few people know about it. I've never heard about it, but it became the forerunner of Auschwitz. Because they were, this was 1942. My mom's mom died in May of 42. And they were experimenting with these gas vans. And once they saw that that worked, then they thought it was very inefficient to have all these trucks, all these vans. Why not just build this huge camp, Auschwitz, and just gas thousands, you know, hundreds of thousands of people at a time? And that's what I mean by it being the forerunner of Auschwitz.
It had to be just an insane logistic and engineering problem, which is your bizarre engineering problem is how do we kill millions of people? But by the way, I have to do it in such a way that's efficient, right. And we can't have them all freaking out and charging guards and panicking and lighting things on fire. And, you know, we need to figure out a way to do it. We need to do it in an orderly, efficient manner.
This exact conversation, almost word for word, is in a movie called Conspiracy. It was with Kenneth Branagh and Stanley Tucci. It's a really good movie. It was an HBO movie, I think. But it's about the Nazi planning of the Holocaust. It's like literally the logistical planning. Like, how do we kill all these people? Like, well, maybe we do this. No, that's too expensive. Yeah. Bullets are too expensive. What if we... And they like happen upon the plan. Well, it's chilling. It's a chilling movie.
A sidelight of that, it just reminded me. My dad's mom, as I said, was exterminated in Theresienstadt. Now, Theresienstadt, they did the medical experiments, but they also used that as a way to put up a good front to let the rest of the world know that they were treating the Jews well. So they took a few of them and they started an orchestra and they would take pictures and then send it around the world. This is how the Jews are living.
Yeah, I think there was a documentary or a movie or something on this. If not that, it was an acting.
That's what they did at Theresienstadt.
Drama club or something.
And then, relating to what you were saying about the planning of all this, towards the end of the war, the way they would exterminate you there is when they did that, then they, my mind's blank. When you die and they burn you.
Cremate.
Yeah. So they would cremate all the Jews because that Jews aren't supposed to be cremated.
Is, by the way, you should never be penalized for not being able to summon the word cremate because it sounds like something you would do to your coffee, not to a corpse.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't have anything part of burn or ash or anything. It's just its own.
Yep.
Well, it's like casualty of war. It's like its own little thing off over here.
And,
yes.
And to add the insult to injury, they would then, after you were dead, they would cremate you, and they kept the ashes of everyone they exterminated in these little jars. They had 10,000 of them. Now, it's towards the end of 44, beginning of 45, the Russians are coming, and Germany's obviously going to lose the war. The German soldiers there at Theresienstadt were scared to death that the Russians would find what they did and torture them beyond, you know, it's well known that the Germans wanted to be captured by the Americans, not by the Russians. So what they did is they took all these ashes and there's a stream that runs through Theresienstadt, which is right outside Prague in the Czech Republic, and they would pour the ashes of the 10,000 people they had there into the river. I tell you that story because at the end of this Who Do You Think You Are documentary, which is a 10-day excursion they give us. My sister and I showed up in London and then with our passports, and then for 10 days they take us around the world tracing our family back to 1773. Part of this journey was to wind up at Theresienstadt. I am there, and so I'm doing this after they explain the whole thing, and then I'm standing right by the creek, and I do a little Jewish prayer, and I notice standing kind of close to me as this other gentleman comes up and he starts praying. And then he comes up to me and he's, you know, and he says, you had a relative here? And I said, yeah, my dad's mom. And he says to me that his grandmother also was exterminated here. And his grandmother was my grandfather's sister.
Oh, wow. God.
They found him. And the BBC found him. We had no idea we each existed. And, you know, you're in the middle of all this emotional, and I apologize, but you're in the middle of all this emotional stuff. And then all of a sudden he says, yeah, he was, you know, and we're hugging each other. He was from Israel. 3 days earlier, the BBC. Now, here's the funny part of the story. 3 days earlier.
Nice. Get ready for the punchline.
That's a comedy podcast. Yeah.
No, okay. 3 days earlier, they found him. He's in Israel. They call him up. He gets a call from the BBC. And they ask, they say, is this, you know, and he said, yeah. And he says, and they want to make sure it's the right guy. Was your mother's name? Was your grandmother's name? Blah, blah. Yeah, yeah. And they say, well, we have found a relative of yours. His name was Yaron. We have found a relative of yours who also, grandparents were exterminated in the camps. Oh my gosh. And we'd like to fly you to the Czech Republic to meet him. That's one of, and the producers will call you back in 20 minutes with who the person is, et cetera. So he's all excited. He's gathering the whole family around. This is a big moment. Now comes the call from the producer, and they say, the relative is Jerry Springer. Jerry Springer, because, you know, they get the show in Israel. Can you imagine? You have this wonderful, beautiful moment. You're going to find out your background, and it's Jerry Springer?
Are you sure? My mother's great grandmother's maiden name was Povich.
Yeah.
Are you sure? Are you sure it's not Maury Povich you're talking about?
Jerry Springer. This is the second worst thing now in my family.
And the whole family. She said the whole family was going, oh, what? But then, you know, he came and, you know, we become really close.
You hit each other with chairs. And yeah.
I love it. Jerry, take a sip of water. What an emotional story. I will say this, interestingly enough, I'm hanging with my friend Dennis Prager today and doing his radio show. We'll be together, by the way, at the Ace Hotel in downtown L.A. on December 12th doing a little talk. I'll tell you something very interesting that he said as it pertains to Jerry's story and what's going on today. What Prager said today that I thought was very interesting. I love it when you hear an interesting idea that you have not thought of. You know, what the Nazis were doing, they were attempting to sort of keep under wraps so as not to outrage the world for the repercussions. What's going on now with Al-Qaeda and ISIS and stuff is exactly the opposite.
Right.
They're advertising everything they do and throwing it up on the internet. It may only be one reporter, but it's going to be a beheading and we're putting it on YouTube.
It's got a lot of mileage.
It's this crazy, weird sort of turnabout that we've had, which is here they are, this is very quietly exterminating tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of millions of people, but mum's the word.
Right.
Now we're relatively taking out much smaller groups of human beings, but we're trying to terrorize the world, so we want to make it seem like it is bigger or it's more prevalent or more grotesque or could happen anywhere.
What's interesting is they're both centered around efficiency. Like, the Germans were obviously obsessed with doing the most efficient extermination they could, and the current terrorism there, they have limited resources, limited people, limited money, a finite amount. They want to get the most terror for their buck. They want to get the most scared people for the one beheading.
We can kill We're only going to kill X amount of people, but we'd like to scare the shit out of and fuck up the airports of as many people, as many cultures as we possibly can. All right, so Jerry, on a happier note, 25 years of doing the Jerry Springer Show.
I apologize.
You can you can go. Jerry has a go listen to Take a Knee. You can hear the whole story. It's very interesting. Jerry's always, I guess you've always had a great sense of humor about yourself. I remember when I saw you on many years ago, we were doing Love Line, and you were doing the movie.
Sure.
Jerry Springer, the theatrical version of the Jerry Springer Show. You never cared about people making fun of you or poking fun at yourself or whatever it was. It's a good disposition. probably the reason you've been going for 25 years. When do we retire? What's the plan?
I've let NBC know that I will be stopping the show when I'm 104.
Oh, wow. 104.
Yeah, because I want to be able to enjoy my retirement. No, I do it. You know, we talked a little bit about this. It's fun. The only reason to do the show is because it's fun. I mean, I'm lucky and I don't need to make a living anymore. So I just do things now that either are fun or like my politics, which I consider important. But it's one of those two categories. This is fun to do. If I go and have dinner with anybody and we go and have dinner and I'm going to say, what was your day like? And you'll say, you know, yeah, it was a tough day at the office. Oh, a funny thing happened at the water cooler. Let me tell you what happened. And then they'll tell me and we'll kind of laugh. Yeah, that was pretty funny. And then you'll say to me, Jerry, what was your day like? And I'll say, I had a guy who married his horse. So I'm always going to have the better story. What a job to have. Every day I go in, they're going to hand me something that is ludicrous.
What's the schedule? What's the physical schedule like?
We live in Sarasota, Florida. So Sunday nights I fly up to Stamford, Connecticut, which is right outside New York City. That's where we do the show. Monday we tape three shows. Tuesday I tape two shows. And after the second show, I fly to Cincinnati to go across the river, Ohio River there in Ludlow, Kentucky, and do the podcast. And then Wednesday, usually Wednesdays through Saturdays, I'm on the road because I host the national tour, The Price is Right, where we do the show in theaters and casinos across the country. And that's fine. I love that because it's a live audience. And
they're so excited to see you and to be there.
Well, they're excited. Let's be honest. The Price is Right is an iconic show. And the reason that, I mean, so people just love showing up. It's a happy show. I mean, you know, my show is always, people are upset because their girlfriend is cheating on them or boyfriend's cheating on them. And Price is Right. It's only fun.
It's Plinko. You
know? Yeah. Yeah.
It sounded to me like you're working 6 days a week or so.
Yeah.
And is it that just your ethic? I mean, is that just always how you've been? Or is it just a
pretty much
make hay while the sun shines? Or what's the.
Honestly, it's I've always kind of, I guess the term is workaholic, but it's always been fun jobs. So I just enjoy it. I can play golf a little bit, but it's not like I can't wait to play golf. And this is fun. So my joys in life now are, and I mean it, my, you know, wife and grandson and daughter. I mean, that the grandson is the best thing in the world. So that, and but if I'm not doing that, my enjoyment comes in the jobs I have. So that's why I do it.
All right, that is it for Cruel Classics today. It was an all-tribute day to Jerry Springer. Rest in peace, Jerry. Tune in tomorrow for the Cruel Classics feed for even more Jerry Springer clips. Until then, mahalo and get it on.